From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, expanding Medicaid in Texas. What is the cost? Who would benefit? And who were the Texas Cedar Choppers, and where did they go? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Texas is one of 19 states that did not expand Medicaid when the Affordable Care Act became law. But for the states that did expand Medicaid, that gave about 16 million Americans health care coverage that they didn't have before. And there's ample evidence of increased usage of health services and improved affordability of care. A study in the Journal of the American Medical Association looked at the outcomes in Arkansas, Kentucky, and Texas. Arkansas used Medicaid funds to offer private insurance to low-income residents. Kentucky opted for a conventional Medicaid expansion, and Texas did not expand its program at all. In the two states that did expand, people had more access to primary care, paid lower out-of-pocket health care costs, and rarely skipped medications. Texas continued to see high lack of access to health care and high infant and maternal mortality rates. One of the problems expanding Medicaid was supposed to fix was the abuse of emergency care services for health care. The same study found that ER usage declined in Arkansas and Kentucky, but not in Texas. But what would happen if Texas voters made a change in elected leadership and they decided to expand Medicaid? What would be the cost and the benefits? A new report from the Urban Institute with funding from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation found that Medicaid expansion would reduce the uninsured population in Texas by 21.2% and decrease the uninsured rate in the state from 21.8% to 17.2%. Matthew Butkins is the lead author of the report, The Implications of Medicaid Expansion in the Remaining States. He says it's not too late for states like Texas to expand Medicaid.
The major change that was made to the Affordable Care Act was with the tax legislation that Congress passed, and that zeroed out the penalties for the requirement to have insurance coverage. Now, granted, that is a part of the ACA, but that is not the whole ACA. In fact, you know, in particular, the ACA expansion of Medicaid is completely unchanged. Those actions in that tax bill will likely raise insurance premiums, and we're already seeing evidence of that next year. But states can still expand Medicaid. In Virginia, they're debating that very issue now. So it is a live issue in Virginia and Maine, and it's being discussed in other states as well.
How would that impact the state of Texas if they were to expand Medicaid?
Okay. So of those 19 states, Texas has the highest uninsured rate currently. It's over 20% of Texas residents lack health coverage. So that means that there's potentially a greater impact, you know, and Medicaid expansion could there's a lot more uninsured out there. So there's, you know, potentially more need for Medicaid expansion, that, you know, if you wish to increase health coverage.
So people make the argument that this would be really expensive for Texas to do.
Okay, so it would increase Medicaid enrollment, and Medicaid is a state-federal partnership, so the state would be, you know, liable for part of the cost of those new enrollees. However, most of those new enrollees would be made newly eligible by the expansion, and under the law, the federal government would pay 90% of their cost, the state 10%. So there would be increased state contributions, but that would bring a lot more federal money, which would have a positive economic impact. But more importantly, that increased state spending is not the full budgetary impact of Medicaid expansion. There are several ways in which states can and have saved money due to Medicaid expansion. We were unable to estimate those for each state for our report, but we showed over a dozen reports in states that have already expanded Medicaid that have found net savings to the state due to expansion, or in the case of one state like such as Alaska, which doesn't have a federal, it doesn't have a state income tax, there would be a slight cost. But for states that have an income tax, generally, the studies have found that the state ends up benefiting on net.
Well, Texas does not have a state income tax. And so then I guess we would follow the path that we found in Alaska, that there would be.
That may be the case. But these things, those savings items depend very heavily on conditions in the state, and they need to be estimated, state by state.
Where would the savings be found?
There are some existing optional Medicaid categories that states have implemented that would become eligible for the new eligible match rate, so the federal government would pay a higher share of the cost of some current enrollees. There are also, would be if states have taxes on healthcare premiums or healthcare providers.
Like they call a bed tax, a hospital bed tax?
Yes, correct. That would bring in additional revenue there.
Who pays that bed tax?
Yeah, so often that tax goes to pay the state's share of Medicaid.
But who pays it?
So the providers pay that, but they also get, in some cases, if that helps pay for the state share of Medicaid, then that actually draws down federal matching funds, which then go back to the providers. So it's sort of complicated who ends up paying for that.
Who would benefit? Who would be put on the Medicaid rolls if it were expanded in Texas, who right now is not receiving health care?
Okay, so we forecast that this could reduce the number of uninsured in Texas by over a million. Now, who would this mainly affect? Well, currently under Medicaid, eligibility thresholds for children are much higher than the ACA's threshold. So we wouldn't see children gaining eligibility, but it would be mainly for adults, and particularly adult non-parents. Because currently there's no income-based eligibility for adult non-parents in Texas. So adult parents and particularly adult non-parents would be the ones to benefit most.
So I mean, that sounds like everybody.
Well, up to the income threshold, which is about 138% of poverty.
Basically, anyone who is low income would qualify for Medicaid under if it were expanded?
Yes. Now, there are some exceptions for immigration status. So
you have to be a U.S. citizen or a legal resident?
Yes, and there are some restrictions on legal residence and Medicaid eligibility as well.
Well, one thing about, the he said, she said argument of, like, what would happen if Texas were to expand Medicaid is that we can actually look at other states and see how it actually played out there, because they did it and they've had it in place. What happened?
We found that the new enrollment met or exceeded predictions in most of the states that currently expanded Medicaid, and of those states that conducted detailed studies of their, for their budgetary impact, the vast majority found net savings. One or two states found that there would be, a small net cost to the state. It has increased coverage. As a matter of fact, our estimates of how many people would gain coverage are based on the actual experience of states that have already expanded. So we know from other states that, yes, there's a lot of demand for it. There will be a lot of new enrollment. It will decrease the uninsured rate. It will decrease the amount of uncompensated care that hospitals and other healthcare providers face. And it will not be, you know, a substantial cost to the state.
Matthew Butkins is the lead author of the report, The Implications of Medicaid Expansion in the Remaining States. The report is from the Urban Institute with funding from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. It found that Medicaid expansion would reduce the uninsured population in Texas by 21% and decrease the uninsured rate in the state from 22% to 17%. This is Texas Matters. I'm David Martin Davies. For more than 150 years, the hills and cedar brakes of western central Texas was populated by a tight society of fiercely independent country folk known as the Cedar Choppers. They were Scot-Irish Welsh migrants from Appalachia who scratched a way of life in the hard scrabble of the hill country and made their cash money by cutting and selling cedar logs. Who were these people and where did they go? Author Ken Roberts set out to answer those questions and more in his new book, The Cedar Choppers, Life on the Edge of Nothing.
A cedar chopper is a person who in the mid-20th century cut cedar posts for a living. They lived in the hill country west of Austin and then all the way out to Junction and Camp Wood and Kerrville, places like that. And they cut the posts that fenced the west.
Who used the term cedar choppers? Was it a self-identified term?
Not so much. It was used derogatorily by other people to sort of designate people who were living a really rough life and who cut cedar. I mean, that was their occupation, but it was a derogatory term. It came into being in about the 1950s. They didn't quite know what to call someone when they were white, but they weren't normal white people. They were living really hard, and they would call them mountaineers or hillbilly moonshiners, stuff like that. But finally, they settled on the term cedar chopper.
Well, what did they call themselves?
They weren't scared to call themselves cedar choppers. I talked to one guy who said, "Oh, my dad was. He'd be proud to be called a cedar chopper because, in fact, and later on, it became sort of a symbol of pride of." A self-identity of I can live that rough. I'm that hard. I can work that hard. So they weren't afraid to call themselves that too.
Is it kind of like a redneck?
Yes, exactly. I think in the same way that it was used derogatorily, but there are plenty of songs that say I'm very proud to be a redneck.
Well, chopping cedar for a living, what's up with that?
That really came into being in the 1940s. A lot of farmland all across America was abandoned for pasture, partly because of the war, partly because of prices. And so that farmland had to be fenced off. Steel posts weren't in production yet. That didn't happen until the 1960s. And so the cedar, these posts that were cut from ash juniper, that's what really it is, it's a juniper tree, very straight. They lasted a very long time. And they would actually outlast the wire that they were hung on. And so given that you had to dig a hole for each of those posts, or any post you put in, you wanted the best possible post you could have. And so it got to be in the 1940s, once you had these trucks that could take them long distances, they could take them all over the West. And so they were the posts that fenced the West.
So cedar post for fencing was then demand, and we had a lot of cedar in the hill country, mountain
right.
cedar, and we had folk that were able to do this hard work with manual labor before chainsaws were out and about, and they would cut it up. And so why did that make them such an unusual class of individual? Why did that make them this rank in our social order, which was seen at the bottom?
Yes. Well, nobody else would do it, so I guess that's part of why they were seen at the bottom. I think another reason they were seen at the bottom was because it was such a hard occupation that you would go out early and you would have cedar wax on you from cutting the post, and that would attract dirt, and so you were always dirty. But the ironic thing is that a man in the 1940s and 50s could make more money cutting cedar posts than in any other form of manual labor. And so they were also unique in that they were probably the most independent laborers in America at the time. They could take their post to any number of yards if they didn't like the price they were given. If They didn't like where they were cutting. Nobody else wanted to do it, so they could just walk off and do it somewhere else. All they needed was an axe and an old truck. And so they were absolutely independent, and they valued that independence a lot.
But you write in your book, The Cedar Choppers, Life on the Edge of Nothing, that it seemed like you're writing about a subculture.
Yeah. Yes, I think they were a subculture. They actually didn't just become cedar choppers in the middle of the 20th century. They were living in the hills along the creeks west of Austin since the late 19th century, after the Comanches were pushed out. They didn't have wells, so they got their water from springs. They grew a little corn and made moonshine from that. They had a few animals, but they really weren't farmers or ranchers. They lived in the hills, and when the Depression and hard times came in the early 20th century, they sort of hunkered down and sort of withdrew into themselves and into the hills, and they all were intermarried families, clans I called them, and they burned charcoal. They were in the cedar, but they took those cedar posts. They were too heavy to get out. They didn't have the trucks in the early 20th century, so they took it and burned it and made charcoal out of it, and then they could haul a lot of charcoal in the town and sell that before natural gas came in and make a living that way, really subsistence living that way. They were very poor at that time.
You write that they were Scots-Irish with roots from Appalachia.
Yes. They came from, the families were identified, their names, and they came from Tennessee, North Carolina, Kentucky, the northern parts of Georgia and Alabama. So they really came from Appalachia. And before that, they had migrated from the borderlands of Scotland and Ireland and Wales. They were called Scots-Irish and had migrated into Pennsylvania, where the Quakers accepted them. But they just sort of kept going over the really fertile farmland right to the mountains, because they were mountain people, essentially. They'd always had cattle, and they were never really farmers. Migrated down through Appalachia to the Ozarks eventually, and then eventually to Central Texas. So they really were, I mean, this is independent of my own research, they really were an outpost here in the hill country of Appalachia. The words they used for cove or holler or were the same. Their language was sometimes called, had an Elizabethan lilt to it. So they really were a subculture.
Well, what about their music?
Oh, well, their music was from old England. And Alan Lomax, who was an ethnographer here, and his father, John Lomax, in Austin, who recorded Leadbelly. Alan was a UT student at the time, and he recorded them in the 1930s. And they would sing these songs a cappella or accompanied by one guitar that were Bonnie Prince Charles and songs that harkened back to England 200 years earlier. And very, very interesting. They can be listened to on the Lomax collection at the Library of Congress.
So that lineage is interesting in and of itself, but it also informed them about life choices that they would make, particularly in regards to things like property ownership.
Yes. There's some things that are hard to explain. Sometimes the best explanation comes from looking back at their culture. And one of the things that's hard to explain is that they could make so much money, yet they didn't ever take that money and use it to, say, improve their home or to invest in property. Now, they would buy a new car or buy a new truck or go spend it on frivolous things, but they just didn't ever seem to value property too much in terms of physical property. And that can be traced back, people say, who have researched this, the Scots-Irish attitude, because they lived so hard. They lived always under the threat of war or confiscation. Cattle were stolen all the time. And so it's just they just didn't really respect property, not nearly as much as they did relationships.
So they were nomadic in a way.
They were. Well, that's where I got part of it, on the edge of nothing, life on the edge of nothing. They had migrated down through Appalachia, and very typically within a single generation you would have more than one move. They would settle a place. Part of that could have been because they were hunting it out, But anyway, they would just sort of kept moving until they got to the Hill Country. And you really can't go much further west in Texas than the Hill Country, or you're out on what they call the Llano Estacado, or the Great Plains. And there's just there was no water and no game out there for, and just no way for them to subsist. So they finally stopped. And then, ironically, this cedar that had come in partly from overgrazing and later from cotton that had really taken over, they turned that into a resource and carved out an economic niche based upon that.
So in this subculture that we're calling the cedar choppers, they also had a fierce disregard for government.
Yes, they really demanded respect. They didn't really care. If government was coming out into the hills, you know, the first sort of instance of government coming out into the hills was when Texas joined the Confederacy. But the Hill Country counties all voted against secession. In the hills of, say, Bee Caves, they would send out the Confederate Home Guard to recruit these guys, you know. And they'd fight them, you know. And eventually a lot of them joined the Union. Then later on, hunters would come out and want to run down deer with dogs. Well, deer were what they ate. That's no good. So they resisted them then. And then they'd come out and want to tax them on their property, and they resisted them then. And then they'd want to come out and bust out their stills, and they resisted them then. So any outsider ever coming out into the hills didn't want anything good as far as they were concerned, you know? And so they just sort of got a society of resistance, of a society that said, don't mess with me, you know?
The cedar choppers, what kind of food did they eat? And they had big families.
They had really big families, you know, very much a sort of Scots-Irish Appalachian culture, you know, to marry, women married young, 14, 15, 16 for sure. You know, you'd have a lot of kids. Kids were economic assets. In the charcoal period, the kids could be stripping the post to make the charcoal and keeping it catching fire. And then later on, kids got an axe when they turned. I've talked to guys who got their first axe when they were 4 years old. You know, most of the time they were certainly cutting by 8 or 10 and dropping out of school. Their median education was about the 5th grade. I'm not sure. I think I digressed.
Yeah, no. So, but you say a lot of kids. I mean, you write in the book that there were some households that would have as many as 15, 20 children.
Yeah, that's true. You know, sometimes for multiple marriages, but they were very inclusive. And if some family was doing poorly and couldn't take care of their kids, they would just take them in. So sometimes they weren't blood relatives; they were just close relatives.
And so to eat, diets consisted of cornbread, beans, and whatever protein they could kill.
Game was very important. Fishing was important. They didn't grow their own food. They really didn't stay in one place long enough, generally, to have a garden.
And so it seems like in your book you're talking about an area that would stretch from Austin almost all the way down to San Antonio and then west to Uvalde and up to, like, Junction.
That's correct. Right. And it actually, Cedar Country goes even further north. John Graves, the famous Texas writer, wrote about Coryell and Palo Pinto County. And it really goes up there, but that was sort of a real outpost. And, I mean, what held these people together was not only the cedar country that we're talking about, the Edwards Plateau, but these people in these counties were actually interrelated. The people that were out in Junction had probably started here in western Travis or west of San Antonio and then moved further west as they cut the cedar out, as the cedar got scarce. So they were of one people. You see the same family names in Junction and Kerrville, Uvalde, et cetera, that you do in Travis and Williamson and Comal counties.
And so those families today, so if you see someone who lives in that area and their last name is Boatwright, you just they say, were your family, were you all cedar choppers? And how would that conversation go?
That's a good question. I think for a lot of people, it would go just fine. They would say, yes, my granddad was a cedar chopper, and he worked, and they would describe it. So given a couple of talks around town, and in each one of those talks, people come up to me who were, in fact, cedar choppers. So, yeah, I think there was a period when they would have been embarrassed by that, say 1970s and 80s. It was just too close to that period when they were looked down upon, and they would say they might not appreciate the question even.
Right, and so what happened to the Cedar Choppers?
Well, technology is really what happened to them. We started importing what we call T-posts, which are a post that can just be knocked into the ground from Japan in the 1960s. And so that superseded, that took a lot of, was a easier way to build a fence than to dig a hole and put a cedar post in it. And the other thing was chainsaws. Chainsaws came out in the 60s, McCullough. They were big things. They were heavy. They'd really wear a man out. But you could probably, if you were a young man, cut more posts with a chainsaw than you could with an axe pretty quickly. And so that combination of demand and the supply went up and the demand went down, it sort of mean you didn't need as many cedar choppers as you did before. That and the environment. We had a horrible drought in the 1950s, The Time It Never Rained, by Elmer Kelton's book. And they were living, they didn't have wells, and so they didn't have water. And they had to move, often into town, took a job, you know, went into the army, just sort of did all sorts of different things, some very successful. One person I highlight in the book owned a quarry and is successful, and another has probably the most famous junkyard in Austin, and it's always been on the fringe of Austin, and as Austin moves out to where he is, he gets rich again. So, you know, you have different stories of what's happened to them.
And the legacy of the Cedar Choppers?
Could be. They could be. I think they, most current Texans, you know, who have come to Texas in the last couple of decades don't really know what they are. But anyone who grew up in Texas, you know, during that period knew about them, both respected and feared them, probably was not going to cross them. We haven't talked about it, but because they cut cedar with an axe all day, they were really strong. They were really fit, and
they walked around carrying axes.
They might even be carrying an axe, yeah. But if they weren't carrying an axe, they had some pretty powerful blows they could inflict on a man. And they demanded respect. They were very independent. They felt pretty good about what they did. And if you insulted them, they're going to put you down. And so that attitude, I think it's part of the Texas attitude. I don't know. That's a really interesting question you asked. There's a lasting legacy, and it might be that we have to sort of recognize the role they played in the formation of the Texas culture to understand what that lasting legacy might be.
They've kind of been forgotten.
Yeah. They were living in the hills in the late 1880s and all the way up until the 1960s. So just preserved almost in a time capsule of Appalachia and of lifestyle.
Ken Roberts is the author of The Cedar Choppers, Life on the Edge of Nothing. It's published by Texas A&M University Press. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org, and you can write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs, and you can find us anywhere you download those podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.